It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Twice a year, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration runs National Drug Takeback Days. These are meant to keep prescription drugs out of the hands of people that they're not prescribed to.
These drug take-back days collect most prescription drugs, but the campaign's main goal these days is to keep unused opioids off of the streets.
In this spring's drug take-back day, the state Justice Department says Wisconsin collected more prescription drugs than any other state.
Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call is with us now for a look at the drug take-back program and wider efforts to deal with opioids here in the state, including the use of money from legal settlements with pharmaceutical companies. Attorney General Call, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Sounds like a success. Why did Wisconsin rank number one in the most recent drug take-back day?
You know, Wisconsin has consistently been at or near the top of the country on the drug take-back program, and I think there are a lot of reasons for that. Fundamentally, I think it's about the partnerships that we have with law enforcement agencies and public health departments around the state who are really committed to this program. We also have over 490 permanent drug drop box locations around the state. And then when the event itself happens, there's a lot of effort to encourage people to dispose of their unused and unwanted medications. And consistently, we've seen Wisconsinites step up and make sure that those medications are safely disposed of.
And people might wonder, how are those medications disposed of? What happens after they're dropped in that drop-off box?
The process is extremely secure. Once they're dropped off, they're transported to a central location in Wisconsin. From there, they are packed onto semis and driven to a facility in Indiana where they're safely incinerated. We always encourage folks to drop off their unused medications in those drop box locations. And the reason for that is if you throw it into the trash, somebody could potentially find those medications. Certainly, if you leave them in your medicine cabinet, somebody could grab them and misuse them. And even flushing medications down the toilet creates risks for the health of our water, because water reclamation facilities aren't able to filter out all of the medications that can be flushed. So safely disposing of them at a drop box location is the best way to get rid of those unused medications. And to find information about a location near you, you can go to the Dose of Reality website and find the closest location.
People might wonder, hey, I have this prescription medication. It's not expired. These things can be expensive. Are there programs for any particular drugs where they can be used by someone who needs them?
What we do is encourage folks, if they have medications that they're not going to use, to safely dispose of them. When we're talking about prescriptions, of course, those are individualized to the person whose prescription they have. Of course, for safety reasons, you wouldn't want people to be recycling prescriptions either. That could create a risk that medications may be tampered with. So what we encourage folks to do is to find a drug disposal location near you and safely dispose of the medications.
The big concern, of course, with a lot of these prescription drugs are opioid overdoses. Nearly 3,000 Wisconsinites died of opioid overdoses in the last 2 years, not just, of course, from prescription drugs themselves. That said, how much of an impact does the drug take-back effort have on that bigger problem?
What we've seen historically is that the opioid epidemic developed with overprescription of opioids and people becoming dependent on drugs that they were prescribed. There have been a lot of steps made to reduce prescriptions and to reduce the problem of overprescription, and I think we're making a lot of progress there. The challenge we face is that the rise in fentanyl, which is now prevalent in lots of drugs that are sold illegally, that has caused the epidemic that we're facing to become much more dangerous for folks who are using illegal narcotics. And we want to do everything we can to ensure that people who are struggling with substance use disorder get into treatment and recovery programs. And of course, we also want to make clear to people that the best thing they can do is not begin using illegal opioids, because the supply of drugs that's out there right now, while it's always dangerous to use drugs illegally, it's incredibly toxic right now because of fentanyl. And it's important for people to take steps to get into treatment and to take advantage of harm reduction measures, which is another big piece of this, which is things like fentanyl test strips or the use of Narcan that can help save lives.
We're talking about statewide efforts to reduce opioid abuse with Josh Call, Wisconsin's attorney general. Following up on that attorney general call, we've got 12 law enforcement agencies in Wisconsin getting grants funded by the state's opioid settlement funds. Can you talk about what these grants will do and how they'll help tackle this opioid problem?
When I took office as attorney general, one of my top priorities was combating the opioid epidemic. And we joined a multi-state investigation into opioid distributors. We also filed suit against Purdue Pharma. And through our efforts, as well as the efforts of state and local governments in other states and local and county governments here and across the country, we have now secured about $750 million that's going to go to communities in the state of Wisconsin to fight this epidemic. Some of those funds are being awarded to law enforcement agencies, as you mentioned. And a lot of those agencies are using the funds for they're taking different steps to combat the epidemic. But a big one that I think is going to be a really important step that that some facilities are taking is to provide medication assisted treatment to people who are incarcerated, who are struggling with substance use disorder. Having a continuity of care for people with substance use disorder can help help people get the treatment they need, but also can help prevent people from recidivating, from committing crimes again when they're out. Because if we can address the underlying issue that led people to get arrested in the first place, which for a lot of people is substance use disorder, hopefully we can help keep our communities safer when those people are released from incarceration.
Are these grants going toward direct enforcement of drug laws, or are they more related, these grants via police departments, to things like treatment and testing?
The way that the state funds have been set up is that I mentioned before that about $750 million have been secured. 30% of that is going to go to the State Department of Health Services. The other 70% goes to county and local governments in Wisconsin. That's happening over a number of years. And then the Department of Health Services proposes how its funds will be spent. In some of the proposals, the Joint Finance Committee has weighed in and allocated a certain amount of money to law enforcement grants. That's happened again with the most recent annual funding bill. And then the Department of Health Services can determine how to award those funds. So law enforcement agencies can apply, and then the grants are awarded. In the case of the dollars that we're talking about now, the funds are going to things like medication-assisted treatment or other efforts to prevent people from becoming addicted. But the funds can be used for any number of purposes to combat the opioid epidemic.
As you've mentioned, Attorney General Call, the big concern right now is fentanyl and other synthetic opioids showing up in the illegal drug supply. What do you see as the key part of the effort to stop people from encountering these drugs?
Well, I think we've got to take a holistic approach. That's what we do at the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I think it's critical. Part of that is ensuring that we are investigating and prosecuting large-scale drug traffickers who are transporting the most dangerous drugs, not only from county to county, but from state to state and across international borders. Fentanyl is prevalent right now in a huge percentage of the drug supply. You know, I've heard from treatment providers that they have clients who show up who, you know, say that they don't use fentanyl, and yet fentanyl is coming up in their system because it's so prevalent. So we've got to dismantle drug trafficking organizations. That requires continued collaboration between law enforcement agencies. But we've also got to reduce demand for opioids, and that is preventing people from becoming addicted. And it also means ensuring that people who are struggling with addiction are able to get the help that they need. And then the other thing I've heard from folks is that fentanyl test strips and Narcan are saving lives right now, and it's critical that we continue to get those folks on the front line of combating the epidemic.
In our last couple of minutes, I want to shift gears and look at some of the big news last week in the legal world. A New York jury found former President Donald Trump guilty on 34 felony counts related to document tampering in the so-called hush money trial. What is your response to that verdict over in New York?
Well, you know, I have a lot of respect for our jury system and confidence that juries carefully weigh the evidence and make judgments based on the facts before them. You know, that's what happened here. The The government in that case had to prove the charges beyond a reasonable doubt, and the jury unanimously convicted the former president of a number of felony counts. What I've been concerned by in response to that verdict is a lot of attacks on our system of justice. We have an incredibly effective justice system in the United States. It's a system that we should be proud of. And attacking it out of loyalty to any one person does a major disservice to all the incredible work that's done. And unfortunately, this is part of a pattern that we've seen where foundational parts of our system of government, that system of government that has helped make the United States the most prosperous, successful country in the history of the world, have come under attack. We've seen that with attacks on the results of our elections and our election system. And now we're seeing it with attacks on the justice system. And I think it's imperative that people in elected positions of both parties reinforce the point that we have an incredibly effective system of law in this country, and that it is a system that applies equally to all of our citizens.
Just in our last half a minute, are there things that the legal system could do to provide transparency, to explain to people why these things happen and answer some of these attacks?
Well, the legal system is not set up for public communication purposes. That's incumbent upon those folks who are in elected office. Our justice system is set up to protect the rights of the accused and to ensure that there is equal justice under the law. Defendants in criminal cases are presumed innocent unless and until proven guilty, and that's what happened that's what happens in every criminal case. Now it's concerning when people in elected office try to mislead the public about what's happening or suggest that the system isn't working, because the reality is that it is an effective system. It's a fair system, and it's one where, again, it's premised on the notion that defendants are presumed innocent until they're proven guilty.
Attorney General,
and then they need to be convicted.
Attorney General Call, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Attorney General Josh Call, Wisconsin's top legal official. He joined us for a look at prescription drug drop-off programs and other issues in the law world.
Just ahead, thousands of church properties are being sold and repurposed each year. A Presbyterian minister in Madison joins us to explain how churches can leave a legacy by having their unwanted buildings serve their surrounding neighborhoods. The book is called Gone for Good. That's coming up on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Researchers with the United Church of Christ estimate that dozens of churches close each week. And here in Wisconsin and across the country, billions of dollars of church-owned property is expected to change hands or be repurposed in coming years.
A new essay collection examines how church communities can transform their properties to better serve their neighborhoods. Reverend Mark Elsden is Executive Director of Press House and Press House Apartments on the UW-Madison campus. He is editor of the book Gone for Good, Negotiating the Coming Wave of Church Property Transition. Reverend Elsden, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, you talk about the importance of churches in your life growing up, and you said literally hundreds of churches have had an impact on you. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so I thought about this recently to sort of think back on my life and the way that churches have impacted my life. I obviously am a clergy member, so there's that part of it, but there's way more connection points than that. I actually got my name, my last name, Elsden, from an orphan baby left on the steps of a church in rural northern England hundreds of years ago. And that baby was named after the town of Elsden, where that church was. And that was the first Elsden, supposedly, in the world. And so from way before I was even around and my ancestors, churches had a role to play. And then since then, there's been so many examples of my parents are immigrants from that area in England, meeting their friends for the first time as new people living in the United States. I met my spouse serving a meal for those who were unhoused at church when I was in college. You know, the list just could go on and on, hundreds of ways churches have touched my life.
One of my favorite was tracking mud into the church. I think it was cross country team, you know, just coming in as you are.
That's right. There was when I was in high school, our cross country team would a few of us would split off from the back of our long runs and go hide and play in the gym, play basketball in the gym while everyone else ran. And we were in a church, in the church gym playing basketball. And then we'd look out the window. And as they came back, we would just sneak out and join the back of the run, you know. So yeah, that was another example of a church gym being really important during that part of my life.
Well, church attendance, as you're well aware of the numbers, religious affiliation has been on the decline throughout the country. There's the latest Gallup survey. The number of Americans with no religious affiliation has doubled over the past 20 years. What effect is this having on church properties? Is there a connection point?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, just the way people engage in their faith is changing, and therefore the way people attend church, or the numbers of people attending church, or the regularity, both, all of that is changing, and therefore the spaces that were built for church attendance, worship, and Sunday school, and those sorts of things are no longer as useful as they were in many settings. And so it is having a ripple effect, a trickle-down effect, you might say, on the property and on the real estate and the buildings and the land. And there just simply is more space, more buildings than needed for the way people are engaging in their life of faith today as they were, you know, 20 years ago and certainly 50 years ago.
You find this moment a defining moment for American Christianity as churches look take a hard look at their properties. Is this getting enough consultation within churches right now?
I think it depends. There are pockets. There are places where people are really wrestling with this, thinking a lot about it. And then there are other places where there's not a lot of conversation happening yet. And I think people are going to be a little caught off guard, you know, and when they sort of realize the implications of this. So it really is a mixture, and it depends on locality, it depends on denomination. But broadly speaking, the issue is pretty much universal across geography, across the United States, across big city, small town, rural, urban, different denominations. All of them are dealing with this in some form or another. Yeah.
And one of the takeaways from the book is that churches and congregations need a really long runway to talk about what that next iteration will be for the church property, that you need a lot of time. And sometimes if a congregation is financially strapped, you don't have that runway. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I often get called or emailed saying we've got, you know, a year left of money. And I think, well, it's a bit late for some of these, you know, these conversations, sort of, what can we do? And there are some things that can be done, but the options are far fewer when that runway is that short. And I always encourage people to be thinking about this way further out. And I actually think the question of how to make best use of church real estate, buildings and land, is really a question for any church, not just ones that are struggling or ones that are going to close or ones that are shrinking, but all of them, even ones that are thriving, because there's so many ways that we can use the kind of the assets, the property and the land and the buildings for good in our communities beyond the ways we're using them currently. And so let's have that conversation really in every church everywhere. And yes, I do encourage people that have a little bit of a horizon to jump on it right away, because there are many, many more options that are exciting and interesting and significant for their communities if they have time to work out those options. And if they don't, they're going to get a little caught out with just selling or closing. Yeah.
What are some of those ways that churches across America are repurposing and seeing their property come to life in new ways?
Yeah, there's so many interesting. Every time I have a conversation with somebody somewhere, I hear new ideas that I haven't thought of before. But there's some very common ones that people might have heard about more recently. Housing is a big one. So affordable housing is a big one that's happening, especially in places like New York City and California and so on. But it's certainly relevant in Wisconsin as well. You know, there's a lot of land available, even where churches are still functioning as a church. Often there's land available where housing can be built. And it's kind of mission-aligned land, land where people might say, we don't need to necessarily derive the very top dollar from this land, so can we offer it in some way, in some partnership to enhance affordable housing options in our community, which is greatly needed in so many places. And then there's things like early childhood education, you know, which is something that churches have been doing for a long, long time, actually. And then, you know, coffee shops is another type of thing, or co-working spaces is one that people have explored. Churches, I know churches that have taken their entire fellowship hall or sometimes even their sanctuary and turned it into a co-working space Monday to Friday, and then they sort of flip it over maybe for Sunday activity, and they activate that space throughout the entire week. And then there's some really much more different types of ideas. People are putting soccer fields on unused green space that they might have. People are putting EV charging stations in their parking lot if they're near a highway. There's churches in rural settings that are partnering with healthcare providers to do kind of part-time health clinics in a setting where a healthcare provider wants to come into the community, but they don't really need to or want to or can't afford to build a standalone health clinic. And they might want, you know, somebody on site 3 mornings a week. Well, a church is a great space for something like that to happen. You know, the list is endless in some ways once people get creative and think about it.
We're talking about how church properties can be repurposed in creative ways with Mark Elsden, a pastor and executive director of Prez House. That's on the UW-Madison campus. It includes a church building, also an apartment community. Can you talk a little bit about the creative transformation of church buildings and the ripple effect, the halo effect on people in the neighborhood who may not be members of the congregation but are benefiting from what is happening on that church property?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting. A lot of folks may not attend a church, may not have attended a church for a long, long time, or perhaps even ever, and perhaps think that the church really is irrelevant to them and doesn't make any difference to them. And I think more of us than we might imagine would be surprised to realize that churches do actually play a lot of different roles in their community. And so Partners for Sacred Places is an organization that coined this term, the halo effect, and they actually studied the economic impact of activity in churches in different parts of the country. And in one of their studies, I believe it was 91% of 89%, I believe is the number actually, of visits to a church in the community were not for worship. They were for something else, visiting a food pantry to pick up some food when bills were tight, or attending an AA meeting, an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in the church, or a neighborhood association meeting, or a Girl Scout troop meeting, or here in Wisconsin, at least in the Madison area, a lot of us vote in churches. And so even though we may not go to worship regularly, there's a whole lot of activity going on in church buildings. And again, sort of thinking ahead, there's a whole lot of other activity that could go on in church buildings. So it's sort of both what we're going to lose when those go away if they don't get replaced, and what's possible.
If the members of the congregation, though, don't live in that immediate community, I think you called them commuter institutions, they come into the neighborhood to attend church, is there a disconnect then on the possibilities of what could happen on that sacred space?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the case. And one of the things that I encourage folks to do in the organization I work with, Rooted Good, we encourage folks to do in our accelerator course is to really listen to the neighborhood, really think about what's going on in their neighborhood. What are the opportunities there? What are the needs there? Who are the folks living around? What are the gifts that they have? And what sorts of services and support could they benefit from? And to try to listen deeply to that and not only to their own prior experience as a member or attendee of that church, because that's where the magic can happen.
They may see the church in a whole new light.
Absolutely. And just simply asking, I often encourage people to just ask, you know, the principal nearby of a nearby school or the council person or just somebody who's there all the time, a local business member, if this church did X for our neighborhood, what would that be? What would you love to see happen here? What could happen here? People have ideas, you know, and sometimes it's just a matter of listening to what those ideas might be.
Civic leaders, local government might have ideas as well. And, you know, it seems as if you're asking those local leaders to step up and see them as assets of the community. Churches also have a nonprofit status. So how does that complicate some of these solutions that require municipal cooperation or buy-in to get established?
Yeah, I think, you know, municipal leadership, so there's a couple elements to that. One, I think that they will, if we don't engage in some proactive activity here, I think a lot of us are going to look back and say, oh gosh, we really missed a chance. So 20 years from now, we really, you know, maybe put it starkly, we need to build some more community centers because we have nowhere for all these activities to happen. Well, we have these community centers essentially right now. They're already here. So rather than thinking, you know, letting them all close and be repurposed to sort of privately owned something or other, can we incentivize the sorts of redevelopments that keep them as community centers in a broad sense of that community-oriented activity, right? And so I think, you know, municipalities have an opportunity to, like I said, support and then incentivize the sorts of redevelopments. So it might be affordable housing, it might be early childhood education, whatever it is that a community needs, to sort of support and incentivize that and disincentivize, frankly, a little bit some of the other types of things that might happen with these repurposings, to avoid us just losing it all. You know, if 40 out of 100 churches in a community or something else in 20 years, that's going to have a big impact on those on the city or on the community, or if 6 out of 8 if in a smaller setting, or even 2 out of 4, whatever it might be, it really is going to matter, right? And so there is a way in which municipal leaders can help encourage some of these things to happen. The city of San Antonio has looked at it, and they at one point said that it's possible they could solve their entire affordable housing crisis with church property alone in the city of San Antonio. Now, I would argue it's not the church's responsibility on their own to solve that problem, right? That's a problem that should be borne by all of us and by cities more broadly than that. But I think it's an interesting sort of reflection that church property, just church property, could be leveraged to solve that problem in a city the size of San Antonio, one of the largest in the country. So that's a fascinating sort of way of thinking about it.
When developers are in the conversation, when they've been invited in by the church, or a developer comes knocking and says, you know, we would love to redevelop this, what are some things that churches should consider when they are negotiating with developers?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question. But I think from my view, it all starts with mission alignment and kind of what you're trying to accomplish. Obviously, dollars matter and, you know, real estate questions matter. But in my view, it's much secondary. Those are secondary to what is the impact going to be. So I often ask and encourage church leadership to say to themselves, let's imagine 50 years from now, we come back to this space. And in most cases, the people in the room won't be around 50 years from now, which is why I sort of said it at that point, right? Myself included. And so 50 years from now, but let's imagine we could come back here. What's happening here? What's happening in this parcel of land or on this property or this real estate that sort of we have to steward at this moment? And is what's happening there 50 years from now something we feel good about? Is that a legacy that we feel really good about? Because we today have the opportunity to shape what's going to happen at that point in the future. And those are the questions I think that really need to drive those conversations with developers. And some developers will get that and will get on board with that and will be able to support that. And sure, they'll make some money on it, but everyone should sort of benefit from it, right? That's fine. And then others won't. Others will not be aligned with that at all. And maybe let them go their way and do something else, right? And so, you know, but those are the starting point questions that I think are most helpful. And then the other ones around how much is it worth and how much do we sell it for, or how do we do this or that, or what's the legal arrangement? Those can all be worked out.
And the risk.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, and the risk, that's right. There are differences in risk, you know, in risk and sort of possibilities for both the church and a partner. But But those, I feel like, can all be worked out later or sort of secondarily to the core questions. Yeah.
As you look across America, then, where do you find hope at this intersection and this transition point for churches?
Yeah, people ask me that a lot. I actually find it a quite hopeful and exciting time. I mean, there's certainly, as a clergy member, the sense of, oh, gosh, the model that I came through and that I know is disappearing rapidly. But when I look back at the story of the early Christian church, for example, or even just really many faith traditions, I don't see an institution. I see people living together. I see a way of life and sort of life together and in community and for each other. And that, I believe, still is going to happen. I still think people want and need these experiences of transcendence and of divine moments. They still care about things that matter to each other. They still want to be in community with people, perhaps more than ever as we live in this digital world that we now live in. And that, I think, is going to continue, it just in radically different form. And in my view, the church has this chance to shift into that and to continue to be the gathered community of people trying to live out their faith in the world. It just, their real estate's going to have to change along with it, right? And so, but it's also a great opportunity. I mean, where, again, let's pick Madison, where you have a whole bunch of properties that are going to be available in the next decade. When else do you have the chance to get property all over the city and in infill locations and amazing spots on bus lines and all over the place and do something new with them and think about doing something new with them? And so let's not squander that chance to do some really community building exciting things on that land.
Reverend Elsden, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Reverend Mark Elsden is Executive Director of Press House, a campus ministry and student housing community at UW-Madison. He is the editor of the book Gone for Good.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, thousands of UW-Madison alums have served in the Peace Corps over the decades. The university's a top producer of volunteers. We check in with three Peace Corps volunteers from Wisconsin stationed at points around the globe. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Peace Corps recently announced that UW-Madison is its number one volunteer-producing university for 2023.
The Peace Corps was created by President John F. Kennedy in 1961 to send American volunteers to live and serve in communities around the world and to eventually return home to share what they learned and experienced.
In the more than six decades since the Peace Corps was founded, UW-Madison has produced more than 2,700 volunteers. We're joined by three of those volunteers who are stationed abroad. They are 2022 graduates of UW-Madison. Abby Buschetti is from River Falls. She's now volunteering in Homa Bay County, Kenya, on the east coast of Africa. Abby, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
And Maya Marwood is from Germantown. We're reaching Maya in Costa Rica's San Jose province. Maya, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Jake Nation from Milwaukee, now serving in Guyana in South America, bordering the North Atlantic Ocean. Jake, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jake, let's start with you as we learn about all of your surroundings, thousands of miles from Wisconsin. What is your environment like where you are in South America?
Yeah, so I'm living in an indigenous village in Region 2. It's mostly made up of people of the Arawak ethnicity. It's like mostly jungle, and I live on the coast. So I live pretty close to the Atlantic Ocean. Most of the people here are either indigenous people or East Indians. So it has like a nice mix of that culture, and it's always nice and sunny here. It's mostly 88 degrees every day. So I'm living pretty much in paradise. So.
Oh, wow. Maya, how about you? What is your setup like in Costa Rica?
Yeah, I live in the mountains in Costa Rica in coffee growing region. So most of the people here work in agriculture. I live in a small community of about 2,000 people. It's beautiful, as you can imagine, the mountains. It rains a lot here. We get heavy rains during rainy season and a short summer where it's pretty nice weather. But I really love it. Also, paradise to me.
And rounding this out, Abby, what do you encounter in East Africa?
I currently live in Kochia, which is a small village in Homa Bay County. About 1,500 people, I think, live there. The weather has been fairly good recently, but it is also rainy season here, so we've been getting a lot of rain, a lot of flooding. They primarily grow pineapples in this region, so I've been eating a lot of pineapples, which is very exciting for me. Yeah, it's a beautiful area, and I'm really happy to be here.
I want to find out what your days are like as a volunteer in the Peace Corps. Going back to you, Jake, walk us through perhaps, is there a typical day?
Sure. So I work as a primary school teacher in Region 2. So I mostly teach grade 6, and I teach all the subjects. So I teach math and English and science and social studies. So my typical day is waking up at around 8 o'clock, eating breakfast, and getting to school by about 8:15 or 8:30. And then I just go through the day as a primary school teacher. It's pretty similar to what I would imagine a primary school teacher goes through in America. We have lunch, and then we go home around 2:30. After that, we're supposed to really mix with the people here, and it's a pleasure to mix with everybody here. And that means a host of things. So you could play football, you could go to the beach. I mean, there's a number of opportunities, but it's mostly free time after 2:30, and just mostly working as a primary school teacher. So.
What do your students ask you about Wisconsin?
The biggest question I get asked is about the snow. Everybody wants to see the snow.
Okay. And Maya, what is your day like in Costa Rica? What are some high points?
Yeah, I also work in schools, but not as a teacher. I work as a youth development volunteer. So I work with students in arts and recreation or leadership and life skills. I also work with parents and service providers. I'm in the schools full time, starting at about 7, and similar to Jake, we leave around 2:30. But I'm not necessarily teaching all day, so I have a little bit more free time to observe classes or spend time with students during their recreational time during the day. I really like it. It's nice to have that flexibility of the structure, but the periods of time where I can more do what I want.
With youth development, what are you helping students do or achieve?
It's the overall goal is to just improve the quality of their like free time, quality of life for youth in Costa Rica. So I do things during the school hours and then also on weekends or during school breaks.
And Abby, for you, walk us through a bit of your day and what you encounter.
I am working as a community health volunteer. So my days are always really different depending on what is needed at the health center I work at. So typically, I do health talks at schools or to target populations at the health center about things like HIV, sanitation, and maternal health. Along with that, sometimes I do home visits with the community health promoters to check on pregnant women and children under 5 to ensure they're receiving the care they need and don't have any problems.
What is healthcare like where you are? What can you tell us about patients and what the needs are?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So healthcare, at least in the village that I'm living in, is very community-based. So I mentioned community health promoters, and they're kind of the people that encourage community members to go to the clinic if they're having any issues. So the biggest problems that people come in with are usually like pregnant mothers who need to get their children vaccinated or need to go to antenatal visits, as well as people that are coming in for HIV testing.
Abby, how might this experience inform what you could take back to Wisconsin with you and what might be the next step in your life?
I really think that the community-based healthcare is a great system. And after Peace Corps, I would love to work abroad or in Wisconsin in public health. So I think the perspectives that I've gained from community members and the community health promoters about how they all help each other and like look out for each other, I think that's a really good thing that could be adopted in the U.S. as well.
How about for you, Maya? Your encounters in schools, are there things, similarities, differences that, things that you've seen in Wisconsin that are very different from where you are in Costa Rica?
Yeah, for sure. Both of the schools I work in are pretty small, so the students are all very close with their classmates. I think some of the grades only have 10 or 12 students. I think the smaller class sizes work great for learning and kind of having a cohort of people that you're really close to. And also here, the teacher-student relationships are a little bit different. They're a lot closer. And I think that it's nice in the United States that we have that boundary between, you know, teacher and student. But sometimes here, it's also nice to have someone that you can really confide in.
We're talking with three recent UW-Madison graduates and current Peace Corps volunteers. Abby Buschetti is in East Africa, Maya Marwood in Central America, and Jake Nation in South America. We're talking about their experiences, and this is as UW-Madison is named a top producer of Peace Corps volunteers. Jake, why do you think UW-Madison is producing so many Peace Corps volunteers?
I think when I think about good volunteers, at least in Guyana, I think about two different things. I think about people that are really smart and people that are really very social. So I think UW-Madison produces a lot of people that are a mix of these two things. Because UW-Madison has such good academics and they have so many social opportunities, it's no wonder why they're producing so many Peace Corps volunteers.
Abby, what led you to the Peace Corps initially?
I wanted to do Peace Corps for a long time since I heard about it in middle school, but most recently I think the courses I took at UW in the African Cultural Studies Department really motivated me to serve in an East African country. I took Swahili at UW, so it was really exciting to be able to utilize that in the place I'm serving. And I think Peace Corps is a great opportunity cultural exchange, and that makes everyone more open-minded, and that is probably my main reason, just to learn more about people outside of the U.S.
What is it like to learn Swahili? How is that do you find that it is something you're able to grow with in that ability to learn the language?
For sure. I think the courses I took at UW were really helpful in creating a good knowledge base of the grammar rules. And I think since I've been in Kenya, I've been able to learn more and more as I go. And my Swahili professor was actually from Kenya, so it was great to be able to talk to him about coming here. And he was really willing to answer all of my questions.
Maya, what was your journey like to the Peace Corps? When did you know that this is what you wanted to do?
Kind of similar to Abby, I found out about Peace Corps in middle school or high school, and since then it was always a dream of mine, something that I really wanted to do. I also think that the internship and volunteer opportunities that are possible by being a student at UW-Madison can really help people with their decision to continue volunteering after graduating from university, and I think that's what really pushed me to apply as well.
Do you think there is any pressure with being a volunteer, knowing that your class is out there in the work world, making a salary? Maya, does that ever come up for you on your mind?
Yeah, definitely. Sometimes I feel like my friends are out there starting their lives, making a stronger income than I make here as a Peace Corps volunteer. And entering the workforce. But I also think that Peace Corps sets up people for a very successful life, no matter what they do. The lessons learned here and the people you meet and the connections you can make are so beneficial. And it's the hardest job you'll ever love. And I really do love it. So I don't regret my decision at all to do Peace Corps.
Abby, I'm going to turn to you and field a totally different question here. But in the healthcare setting, you know, here we've seen so many advancements in technology like artificial intelligence and really changing how we approach our jobs. Are there any opportunities for that in developing nations? And what do you see by way of technology in healthcare where you are?
Wow. Yeah, that is a huge question. I think I can only speak to the health center that I work at, but funding is definitely an issue. But they have utilized technology a lot in the lab for testing malaria, HIV, and that kind of thing. So I think there's definitely a lot of opportunity to continue utilizing technology. But like I said, I believe just the lack of funding from the government and other organizations can make that difficult, but I think they're doing what they can with what they have at this moment, for sure.
Maya, do you have any technological tools in the education setting that have been helpful to your students?
Kind of similar to what Abby was saying, there are some budget issues, so most students don't own a computer. So that can be very difficult. There are computers available at school, but not one for every student. In terms of with the teachers, AI has been very helpful in helping to create lesson plans or generate ideas for more hands-on learning. And also programs like Canva that offer, you know, programs for free for educators have also been really helpful in implementing lesson plans and ideas in the classroom.
I want to ask each of you as we close, what gives you hope for the world's future based on your Peace Corps experience? Jake, you first.
One idea here in the Caribbean is that you can just pretty much slow down. You can slow down your time here and you can slow down your pace. And at a place like UW-Madison, I think a lot of people are living a very fast life and it feels good just to be able to slow down. And so it gives me hope for at least my own future that in the future that I can just slow down and appreciate things, appreciate small things and just take time for family and friends.
Being present. Abby, what gives you hope?
I totally agree with Jake on this. I feel like one of the biggest takeaways I have from Peace Corps so far and my time in Kenya is that you don't always have to be in a rush and not everything is urgent. Like, you don't need to get a job right out of college. You don't need to have your whole life plan set up. So I think, at least for me, and I hope other Peace Corps volunteers and people that one day may volunteer with the Peace Corps can also come to that realization that, yeah, like Jake said, there's so much joy in the little things. And I know that's kind of cliche, but I think that is what gives me hope, at least for my life and the people around me that I can share my experiences with going forward.
And Maya, you have the last word on this.
I think the levels of kindness and empathy I've seen from the people here in Costa Rica give me a lot of hope for the future, how people can live very fulfilling and happy lives, living so differently than we do in the United States, and still be kind and show people empathy is really inspiring, and I hope to carry that with me throughout my time after Peace Corps.
Thank you all for joining us and taking time out of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Abby Buschetti, Maya Marwood, and Jake Nation, they are all recent UW graduates and current Peace Corps volunteers, and we talked with them about their experiences abroad and what lessons they hope to bring back to Wisconsin.
Students are wrapping up the school year in districts around the state, which means a lot of summer reading programs are kicking off.
That's right. Next week, we'll check out a program from the state to help make sure everybody has summer reading opportunities by making Braille and talking books available to students around Wisconsin.
In the meantime, we want to hear from you. What do you look for in a great summer read for yourself or for your kids?
And do you read Braille books, talking books, audiobooks, or the Bard system for reading?
Let us know. Call our text us now at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Kate, what are your kids reading these days?
We've got a middle schooler who is exploring Stephen King.
Ooh, too scary for me.
And we've got SpongeBob detective mysteries going around the
still
house.
Still pretty scary.
Patrick is still lost.
Oh, no.
This Justin.
No, not Patrick. Let us know your summer reads. Call 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is WPR News.
Wisconsin Public Radio's sustaining members know how great it feels to provide informative and meaningful news, talk, and entertainment that make a difference in their community. If you're not a sustainer yet, make your impact today. Take a few minutes to set up an ongoing contribution of $10 or $20 a month from your credit card or bank account. Get started now at WPR.org/donate. Thank you.